Former White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman found guilty today on 5 counts in the Watergate cover-up trial. Former White House Domestic Affairs Advisor John Ehrlichman, 4 counts, guilty. John Mitchell, former Attorney General and head of the Nixon Re-Election Committee, 5 counts, guilty. Robert Mardian, former political coordinator for the Re-Election Committee, 1 count, guilty. Kenneth Parkinson, lawyer for the Re-Election Committee, 2 counts, the only defendant found not guilty.
This is a special report from CBS News in Washington. The Watergate verdicts.
Good evening. Some of the defendants in the Watergate cover-up trial left the federal courthouse here in Washington last night expressing wishes for a happy new year. But most of them were not surprised when their own new year began today with the jury finding all but one of them guilty. The verdict came 2.5 years after the Watergate break-in and 13.5 weeks after the trial began. In those weeks, more than 12,000 pages of transcript were accumulated as more than 80 witnesses appeared, and 34 of those famous White House tapes were played. CBS News correspondents Fred Graham and Jed Duval were at the trial from its beginning October 1st until its end late today. Fred, first, what about the case against H.R. Haldeman?
Well, the case against Haldeman was the strongest of all because as Richard Nixon's right-hand man, he was the one most often recorded on the tapes, and they destroyed him. The most damaging was the conversation with Mr. Nixon on June 23, 1972, in which they agreed to use the CIA to block the FBI's investigation of Watergate. It was enough to force Richard Nixon from the presidency, but Haldeman told the jury they didn't do it to cover up Watergate, but just to avoid political embarrassment. Haldeman also turned over a secret $350,000 White House cash fund that was paid to the burglars. He said he didn't know it was to be used as hush money, but again, the tapes made it clear that Haldeman knew. Finally, the jury found that Haldeman lied under oath when he took the stand before the Senate Watergate Committee to defend Richard Nixon against the allegations of John Dean. Haldeman insisted that he's innocent.
I'd just like to make a very brief statement, simply to say that there's only one human being in the world who knows to an absolute moral certainty the truth of my innocence or guilt. I know that legally and morally, I am totally innocent of each of the charges that's been brought here. And with that certainty, I can live with myself. And I can move ahead now to see that as this process continues, the truth ultimately does become known and become understood. I have the full conviction that ultimately it will. And with that, I intend to move ahead in the days ahead on the process of appeal within the judicial system. Thank you very much.
John Dean and Herbert Kalmbach hooked John Ehrlichman to that money that was given to the burglars and their attorneys. It was Dean who told the jury that Ehrlichman told him to deep six some of the evidence. On the witness stand, Ehrlichman tried to explain himself out of the CIA involvement by saying that all he did in the key meeting was say to one of the intelligence officials, "Here, you can use the phone." Back in May of 1973, nearly a year after the break-in, Ehrlichman sat before a grand jury and was asked if he had known of Gordon Liddy's involvement in Watergate. His answer was, "I don't recall," several times. More lack of recall when asked about Herbert Kalmbach and that hush money, and the jury decided that his statements were false and he knew it. And, after the verdict, he said, "It does not change my deep-seated feeling of innocence."
When you weigh it against the harm done in the whole process, I suspect that history may strike a different balance than some of the instant commentators are striking right now.
Mr. Ehrlichman, are you saying that too much has been made of Watergate, really?
Well, I'm saying that it is possible to make too much of it, and somehow or another, I think someone who stands a little farther away from these events is going to have to take a long view and make that balance. Obviously, neither you nor I can. I suspect that not even Eric Severide could.
The charge against John Mitchell was that he approved the Watergate break-in and then joined the conspiracy to cover up his guilt. He was pictured as the big enchilada who manipulated the cover-up from the background, holding meetings at his apartment to plan cover-up strategy, suggesting that Jeb Magruder have a fire in the summer and drop some evidence in it, arranging to have others make hush money payments and lying to the grand jury. Mitchell said it just wasn't true, that he had nothing to do with the break-in and thus had no motive to cover it up. Sure, he concealed facts about Watergate, he said, but he did it to protect the president's re-election, not to obstruct justice. Mitchell was the trial's mystery man, puffing his pipe, cracking occasional jokes, refusing to attack Richard Nixon, even after the tapes proved that Mr. Nixon had betrayed him, and saying little else. Tonight, after the verdict, his style hadn't changed much. When asked if he was going to appeal, his answer was, you'd better believe it.
It may be the evidence that hurt Robert Mardian, evidence of a telephone call placed to Gordon Liddy's number only hours after the Watergate arrests. Or it may be Mardian on the stand that hurt Mardian's case, snapping and snarling so much at the government's Jill Wine-Vollner that Mardian's attorney, Tom Green, apologized for it in his closing argument to the jury. Is that relevant? Mardian once shot at Ms. Vollner. Another time. What do you want me to say? Yes, yes? It was Mardian who claimed that the real day-to-day director of the committee to re-elect was then-President Nixon himself. He discovered this, said Mardian, only when he found the decisions of his friend and mentor, John Mitchell, being overruled, and figured there was only one power that could accomplish that. Mardian discussed commitments to the Watergate burglars, the government charged. Commitments the jury evidently considers to mean promises to buy silence from those who broke in and were arrested. Mardian was there in John Mitchell's Washington apartment on the evening of June 19th, 2.5 years ago, when Mitchell talked to Magruder about that fire at his home. Magruder did it. Mardian had heard it. And it was Mardian who this evening, dogged by a reporter to his hotel room, burst out in fury, used language unheard even on the tapes, and was calmed by John Mitchell.
There was a gasp of appreciation in the courtroom today when they announced the acquittal of Kenneth Parkinson. He had presented himself as the Mr. Clean of this case, the politically naive lawyer and doer of good civic works, who was hired as respectable window dressing by the Nixon men, who didn't tell him they were involving him in obstruction of justice. Parkinson's lawyer, Jacob Stein, stressed that Parkinson was an outsider, so different from the politicians that Stein said he was probably helping crippled children at the moment the Nixon men were planning to hire call girls to subvert the Democrats. Parkinson had his credibility problems. He told the jury he didn't read a list of money demands from the burglars that he Xeroxed and passed along to the White House. But in the end, even if the jury didn't fully believe him, they apparently felt he was a victim, not a participant in the cover-up. Afterward, he and his lawyer played it calm and cautious.
I said then that I was innocent and that that my friends could count on. There would come a time when I would be able to clear myself, and that time's come today.
Do you think those prosecutors were too aggressive in this case?
Now, Fred, you're being too aggressive.
Could you answer that?
We wouldn't want to comment on that.
What are you going to do now?
Go home, take a hot bath.
The prosecution team was headed by James Neal of Tennessee, best known before Watergate for his prosecution of Teamsters President James Hoffa. Neal, who had dramatically argued in the courtroom that the cover-up defendants had defiled this country's highest offices, was subdued today when asked if he now felt satisfied.
I don't think satisfied is the word. It's one of relief that a long and hard job is over, and I can go home.
How do you feel about the verdict?
Well, you practice law for long enough, you just let the juries decide, and you live with them.
Were you surprised?
Whether they accept your theory or not.
Came nearly 5 months after the cover-up scandal forced Richard Nixon to resign as president to be succeeded by Gerald Ford. Mr. Ford was still vacationing in Colorado when the jury's decision came in. Phil Jones reports.
President Ford was watching the Rose Bowl football game today when the verdict bulletin came in. After discussions with some of his advisors, the president decided not to make any public comment on the verdict because, in his new secretary's words, the president doesn't have anything to say about it. However, one of Mr. Ford's closest advisors has told CBS News that today's verdict appears to be a careful one, and that even though one hates to cheer about anybody's misfortune, this was a wholesome verdict for good government.
The same aide, who was asked not to be identified, says there is no chance that the convicted Watergate defendants will receive a presidential pardon. The Ford administration does not expect this verdict to provoke more criticism of the Nixon pardon, and in the view of this one aide, today's verdict proves that the truth could still be ascertained after the Nixon pardon. And the aide continued, today's verdict establishes that former President Richard Nixon was involved in the cover-up conspiracy and that Mr. Nixon was also guilty of criminal conduct. Phil Jones, CBS News, with the presidential party in Colorado.
Today's verdict does not mean the end of the legal line for the four convicted cover-up defendants. John Ehrlichman said the legal process is a journey of 1,000 miles. He and the others plan to appeal their convictions. More on that from Fred Graham.
The final irony of Watergate could be the difficulty that these convicted men may have with their appeals because of the four law and order justices that President Nixon and John Mitchell put on the Supreme Court. These justices succeeded in writing into the law a new concept of harmless error. That is, the rule that even if the defendant's constitutional rights have been violated, his conviction won't be overturned if it appears that he was so guilty that the jury would have convicted him even without the error. Defense lawyers concede that this new law and order mood hurts their chances of success. Before the verdict today, Judge Sirica agreed to have his picture taken with the reporters who covered the case, and it was a mild example of the kind of unusual judicial behavior that created some talk early in the case that he might have committed reversible errors. But then things settled down, and lawyers on both sides said he had run a fair trial with no obvious reversible errors. Therefore, the defense lawyers intend to focus their appeals on decisions Sirica made before the trial began. One point they'll stress is that prejudicial publicity so soon after the Nixon resignation and pardon made a fair trial in Washington impossible.
Long ago as last March, when this indictment was delivered, we began to express our very strong and sincere concern about anyone's ability to get a fair trial under the circumstances in this district. And by a fair trial, I mean in the political setting and with a massive pretrial publicity, the pervasive publicity. And I think when the record of the jury selection process is finally released, you'll see how terrifically pervasive all this political publicity and the impeachment publicity and so on has been.
Another point is that Judge Sirica insisted on trying this case himself, even though it was he who has said all along that the involvement of higher-ups in Watergate was being covered up. Defendant Robert Mardian will appeal on the ground that he shouldn't have been tried with the three major defendants and that the jury simply convicted him along with the big three. But the point that the defendants think is their strongest point is Judge Sirica's refusal to delay the trial until former President Nixon was well enough to testify.
I felt strongly, and my attorneys advised me very plainly, that Mr. Nixon's testimony was absolutely essential to the establishment of our defense. When the judge ruled that we couldn't wait five more days to take his deposition, that was, for my money at least, the major turning point in whether or not this verdict was going to be a statement about my innocence or was simply going to be a statement about the evidence that was presented in the courtroom.
Well, during this trial, orchestra parlance was used. Was Mr. Nixon the orchestra leader?
Well, I think everybody knows as much about that as I do at this point, and is going to have to draw his own conclusions. My attorney argued.
He had been pardoned in advance of any possible prosecution himself, but those convicted today were some of the men closest to the former president while he was in office. Mr. Nixon's feelings about the jury's verdict, however, have so far remained private, as Richard Wagner reports from California.
Whatever reaction former President Richard Nixon had to the convictions of H.R. Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, and Robert Mardian was kept behind the walls of the Nixon compound here in San Clemente. The Coast Guard gate was closed and unmanned on this New Year's Day, and the Coast Guard telephone operator told callers that Mr. Nixon's office was also closed for the day. With the exception of periods of hospitalization in Long Beach, 50 miles away, Mr. Nixon has been in almost complete seclusion here since he resigned the presidency last August. According to medical reports, he has been too ill to travel, and he has been keeping his own counsel. The Coast Guard reports Mr. Nixon's office will be open in the morning, but there is no definitive word from inside the walls when or if the former president will have anything to say about the convictions of the men closest to him when he occupied the highest office in the land. Richard Wagner, CBS News, San Clemente, California.
It was New Year's Day, and like millions of Americans, John Mitchell watched a football game on television in one of the offices provided for the defendants near the courtroom. H.R. Haldeman stretched out on a couch to read. Kenneth Parkinson stretched out on a couch, period. John Ehrlichman's lawyer, William Frates, host of a New Year's Eve party for the press, recovered on another of the lounges. No one knew the jury was in its last innings, the decision's not far away. No one knew it when an incongruous frivolity inserted itself, the reporters deciding to pose for a group picture. Judge Sirica accepted an invitation to get in the middle of the shot, and so did a few of the defense lawyers. The judge wished everybody a Happy New Year and gleefully reported his favorite Christmas present, son Jack shaving off his beard for Dad. Less than an hour later, word flew. Verdict. The jury has a verdict. A stampede for the courtroom. There, quiet. A room bristling with tension. 4:49 p.m., Judge John Sirica, who 21 months ago opened a letter from James McCord and read that higher-ups were involved in Watergate, entered the room. All rise. 30 seconds later, the jury, foreman John Hoffer in the lead, carrying a brown envelope. 4:52 p.m., clerk James Capitanio, holding the papers, turns to his left and gently asks, "Will the defendants please stand?" The five rise. For most of the trial, their attorneys have been the main players. Now they are facing it alone, five silent figures. Mr. Capitanio reads, "As to defendant Mitchell, count one, guilty. As to count two, guilty. Guilty. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mardian, guilty. Guilty. Guilty." Cannon shots across the room. Mrs. Jean Ehrlichman, eyes lowered, four wives seated together, smiling at Pamela Parkinson when her husband is declared not guilty. Mardian is the only one who breaks. He looks like this, and he is shaking, and it lasts for several minutes. Mrs. Mardian, as the jurors depart, has given them the Bronx cheer. The last the jurors heard was Judge Sirica's warning not to discuss the case. "I cannot prevent you," he said, "but it detracts from the dignity of judicial proceedings." Hal Walker asked jury foreman John Hoffer whether it had been an ordeal.
"I think so. It's, I guess, could have been worse and could have been better. The process of taking my, putting my things away, I haven't had time to even think about it."
"Glad it's over?"
"Oh, yes. It isn't a pleasant thing to do, to convict somebody. Or give such words.
Did you feel you did right?"
"Well, I'm not even thinking about it. We've done our best we could."
Ruth Gould is the juror who, most observers agree, paid closest attention during the trial.
"I don't want to distract anyone. I really don't. They were really great, and I just don't want to. I always want to know where they are. I always want to keep track of them."
"What kind of experience it?
It was a wonderful experience. Wonderful experience. And it's a wonderful institution. Don't ever forget that.
What, the jury system?
The jury system is a wonderful institution. If ever I had any doubts about it, I don't have any doubts now."
All of the charges against the cover-up defendants were felonies, and unless overturned by appeals, today's verdict could mean jail terms for those convicted. Details from Fred Graham.
Theory, the four convicted men could be sentenced to a total of 75 years in prison. Mitchell, 25 years. Haldeman, 25 years. Ehrlichman, 20 years. Mardian, 5 years. In fact, the sentences are almost certain to be much lighter than that, and because there have been so many Watergate convictions already, it's possible to predict with some degree of confidence about what those sentences will be. There's an agreement between the judges in Washington to apply a consistent scale of sentences in Watergate cases. So far, the judges have generally succeeded in matching the prison terms with the importance of the offender's role in the Watergate scandal. Egil Krogh, deputy chief of the White House Plumbers Unit, got 6 months. Jeb Stuart Magruder, deputy director of the Nixon Reelection Committee, 10 months to 4 years. Charles Colson, special counsel to President Nixon, 1 to 3 years. John Dean, counsel to the president, 1 to 4 years. John Ehrlichman, convicted previously of approving the Ellsberg break-in, 20 months to 5 years. Based on this scale, the sentences of Mitchell, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman could well fall into the 3 to 5 year range, with Marion receiving substantially less than that. These men will remain free until all appeals are exhausted, if the cases go to the Supreme Court, and that could take more than 2 years. Criminologists say prison sentences should serve three purposes: punishment, rehabilitation, and deterrence. And for that reason, the Watergate sentences have caused some anguish among lawyers. Some say it's punishment enough for these men to be disgraced and convicted, that they don't need rehabilitation, and that none will ever be in a position to commit such crimes again. The only benefit of prison, they say, is to help assure that in the future no Watergate will ever happen again.
While White House officials were discounting the possibility of presidential pardons for those convicted, so too was John Ehrlichman when asked about that possibility.
Pardon has a problem associated with it now, because in the aftermath of the presidential pardon, a lot of statements have been made that it carries with it a connotation of guilt. Nothing has happened to in any way shake our confidence in my innocence, and I certainly wouldn't want to encourage any thought on anybody's part that in the context of a pardon that I was guilty. I don't feel guilty. I know I'm not guilty of the charges, and I simply would have to hesitate a long, long time. Now, balanced against that is the fact that to maintain one's innocence and to defend a case of this kind costs an enormous amount of money, which I don't have. And there have become practical considerations at some point as to how one puts an end to all of this.
It was a bleak way to start the new year for four of the Watergate cover-up defendants, but Eric Severide takes a broader look in this commentary on the results of the trial.
It's as good a way as any to face the new year by forgetting the old one. And the end of the Watergate trials makes that a little easier. 74 begs forgetting. A former attorney general, he would be called Minister of Justice in some countries, stands convicted of crimes. Lawyers broke the law. Because they were only trained in the law, they were not educated in it. Somehow the great spirit of the law escaped their notice. Two men described by Richard Nixon as the finest of public servants turn out to have been private servants, exclusively serving Richard Nixon, his needs, ambitions, his fears, and his hatreds. None of them did what he did for money, which makes Watergate different from and worse than all previous federal scandals. Money corruption at the top may dismay the people, but the corruption of power at the top disorients the processes of government and endangers the people. These men confused the Nixon presidency with America itself. What was good for Nixon was good for America. Well, Jefferson said something to the effect that tyranny springs most often from the fanatical pursuit of virtue. The Nixon crowd did not bring the country anywhere close to tyranny. They had the taste for it, but they chose the wrong environment. A tyrant would first have to subvert certain institutions: the press, the Congress, the FBI, the courts. Instead, it was these institutions that exposed and broke up the whole affair. No more neurotically insecure man than Richard Nixon ever occupied the American presidency. He saw enemies everywhere because he needed them. He needed them to feel alive and consequential. The weird White House taping process may have been designed to trap enemies, current or prospective, but it merely trapped the trapper and his assistants. Nixon helpers are found guilty, but so is Nixon, by the pardon and his acceptance of it, and by his silence as defendants day after day lay the ultimate blame on him. He is living out a life sentence in the maximum security prison of his own mind. These four felons may go to prisons of stone and steel, but even their most implacable foes seem to have little stomach for severity. They will appeal, of course. They claim it was an unfair trial, a political trial, of course. And some people, of course, will agree with them. But most people, weary and numb by it all, are likely to react as Emerson reacted to a certain person. "What you are," he wrote, "speaks so loudly, I cannot hear what you say."
As we said early in this broadcast, Fred Graham and Judd Duval have been covering this trial from its beginning until its end today. And I wonder what strikes you now after all these weeks as being unique. What makes this trial different from others, perhaps?
Well,
Barry, that's so easy because this case is unique, if not just because of the names that were involved in the events, but the tapes, the White House tapes. There's certainly never been a trial before like this in which people of this stature were actually heard by the jury plotting some of the alleged acts that were charged. And it made it almost impossible for those three who were on the tapes, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell, to defend themselves in the normal way by saying that the evidence against them, the testimony against them, was mistaken or perjurious. They just didn't have a chance.
Jed?
What was unique, too, Barry, was the presence of the former president throughout the trial, despite the fact that he was from California. William Prady's discussed the missing orchestra leader, he said, the man who was not here, and, of course, his voice on the tapes. But the presence, the charges that he said this, but he didn't say this, he was responsible for this.
Richard Nixon did seem to haunt this trial, the attempts to get him here to at least get his written testimony, the way his name came up in all the arguments. I gather this is going to be a basis for appeal, at least as far as John Ehrlichman is concerned, the fact that Richard Nixon was not physically here.
Well, it'll be true of the big three, because all three said that they wanted him, and they feel it's their strongest point. It's intriguing to think that if they went on that point, a new trial would be ordered. And at that trial, if the former president has recovered, he would testify.
Jed and Fred, thank you very much. There will still be appeals and perhaps even further indictments in connection with Watergate. But with the end of this historic trial, there have now been more than 50 convictions or guilty pleas relating to the scandals that have borne that collective name. And it appears that it may finally be true that, as President Ford said prematurely last August, our long national nightmare is over. I'm Barry Serafin, CBS News, Washington. Good night.